From side hustles to success stories, this is the Finance Ghost plugged in with Capitec, where we explore what it really takes to build a business in South Africa. Priscilla Msimanga took the leap from corporate and went from senior IT roles to buying a shell garage in Boksburg. Welcome to this episode of the Finance Ghost plugged in with Capitec. What a wonderful podcast season we are having. We've spoken to some really interesting entrepreneurs doing all kinds of different things. We've covered retail, we've covered restaurants, we've covered pharmacy, we've covered a whole bunch of things. And today we are doing something completely different. And what I'm particularly excited about with this podcast is that we will be speaking to someone who has done something that so many people dream of. And that is to leave their corporate job and go off and either start a business or acquire a business. So many of the other people I've spoken to on this podcast season, they either started the business quite young or they'd been entrepreneurs for a very long time. Whereas for Priscilla Msimanga, she's the owner of Shell Boksburg Motors. This is actually quite new for you, which I think is great. So nice, fresh journey into entrepreneurship, having left the typical corporate jobs, very senior roles. So Priscilla, thank you so much. Really excited to just get to know you and to talk about this, because as I say, I think what you've done is something that many people, when they sit in traffic on the way to work, fantasize about doing. So congratulations.
Thank you. Good morning, Ghost, and then good morning to your listeners, and thanks for having me.
No, it's great to have you. So I think let's jump straight into that path that you have traveled, and then we'll talk about the business that you own today. So let's just get a backstory here. What was your career before you decided to get out of corporate and go into entrepreneurship?
It was a weird sort of career, right? So I studied business engineering, but I ended up in IT about 20 years ago by chance, because I'm one of those people who like taking risks. So I went into IT. I got to move into SAP after being headhunted and went into head of IT, not head of IT, but sort of service operations manager, which is a head of IT at a smaller scale for a site, which was Egoli. That's what my journey started with IT. And until 3 years ago, when I decided I need to pursue my life. I've always been an entrepreneur at heart. I've always been that person who grew up in the dusty street of Sebokeng, but selling stuff. My mother never had a job. He made jobs by selling and had a spaza shop. So that's where the passion came from. From a corporate perspective, grew up in the ranks and became head of IT for a multinational in Cape Town. Two multinationals, actually. By the time I left, I was a head of BSS for Mixed Telematics. Before that, worked for Philip Morris. But Mixed Telematics was more of a contract role because I had started now on the journey of I want to be an entrepreneur. I want to build a legacy as opposed to being an employee. So yeah, that was kind of my journey. Loved corporate, loved IT, loved doing it, loved the interaction with people. That was my passion. My last VP actually said to me, "You are more of a marketing person than an IT person." I'm like, "Yeah, maybe I am." So yes, that's how I started my journey. It wasn't easy living corporate because of the security around where your next salary is going to come from. I've grown quite a bit. I have a growth mindset, studied quite a bit. You don't have to pay for it. They actually pay for it. So it is quite easy to do that. So it wasn't a very easy decision to say I'm going into an entrepreneurship, but I was pushed more about building my own legacy, actually being an employer as opposed to being an employee.
Absolutely. I love that story. So I always laugh. There's this kind of standard joke that goes along the lines of, instead of working 40 hours a week for someone else, I want to work 60 or 70 hours a week for myself. Because entrepreneurs, of course, have gone through the long hours. They understand this. I mean, I'm sure that's been your experience as well. Although it doesn't sound like your jobs were exactly 40 hours a week to start with. But I think there's a good underlying point there around just what it's like to go from corporate into an entrepreneurial environment and actually deal with that adjustment. I love the reference there to taking risks and that informal economy experience when you were growing up. It's amazing how those experiences shape what people do later in life. It really is. And it comes through as you speak to entrepreneurs. They all have a relatively common thread that goes through their backstories around either their parents were hustlers or they were, or it's side gigs or it's varsity jobs or it's, you know, something at high school, like something triggered an interest for them and then it stayed with them. And that comment you made about being more of a marketing person, I also really like that, because if you work for yourself, you work in sales. Primarily, you work in sales. You've got to keep everything else going, all the operational stuff, but you're a salesperson. So well done on making the leap. I think that's fantastic. How did you actually make the final decision? Because as you say, it's not an easy thing to do. It's not an easy decision to make, especially with large corporates. It is quite a nice safety net. And like you say, lots of opportunities to grow, to study further. When you get to that level, you're leaving behind quite a lot. And I think that's what stops people from doing it. So what was the final decision for you? What made you say, that's it, I'm out of here, I'm leaving corporate?
Age and moving to Gauteng. This was weird how this came about, right? A friend of mine, while I was busy with a presentation for the Expo, said to me, there is a site in Luhamka of all places. And she kept on pestering me. And I'm like, okay, let me just do this for them. Let me get it out of the way. Because she already acquired one. And 2 years later, then the process started, right? And I'm still working. And I'm like, you know what? Maybe let me pursue this. And it started being interesting. I'm like, I don't know this. And I want to see what it has got for me. Because I always took risks. I'm like, I'm going to go for it. And that was the time where I made a decision that, you know what? In 2 or 3 years, I must be out of corporate. I had to move to Gauteng in 2022, actually. And then I got to do the job with Max in 2023. But during that time, when I got into Max, it was already set up. It was just getting a site and getting in there and starting the business. Because I started in 2024. I was appointed in 2024, very early, around Feb. So yeah, that's how it started. So it was like more of a push that you've got to go. Now it's time, because I put it off from the age of 27 until later in life that I needed to go. So until later in life, I'm like, if I don't do this now, I'll probably never do it. And then I just decide to just not go for corporate anymore and pursue this full time.
So the one thing there that's so interesting, Priscilla, and it's, I think also my own experience, so true, is that kind of 2 to 3 year runway from when you decide, okay, it's time to go. It's almost impossible to then do it straight away. You still got to actually give yourself runway. And 2 to 3 years is pretty common, actually. So I think mine was even longer than that. I had the spreadsheet on my computer for a very long time called Escape Plan. And what Escape Plan was basically me making sure that whenever I added a monthly overhead, I used to put it on the Escape Plan and be like, look, is this an overhead where there's like no flex? Is this an overhead where it can go away if it needs to? And then what would I have to earn in order to escape? And people just wake up, you know, they look at a successful entrepreneur and they go like, oh, like this guy or, you know, this lady, they just like left corporate one day and it worked. It's not actually how it works. You've got to plan for this thing and you've got to adapt your life to it. You've got to get ready for it. Maybe we can chat about that just now. But what I would like to understand, you know, you talk about these sites being ready. So this is the decision to go into fuel retail, these forecourts.
Yes.
As I said earlier, Shell Boksburg Motors, that's you. So from Cape Town to Boksburg, that's a reasonably unusual path. I think there's the other way around is more common, let's be honest. So from Cape Town to Boksburg, you went and got this forecourt site. So how did this happen? How did these sites become available? What was the situation to be able to get one to qualify? Like, what was the backstory that got you to say, not only am I leaving corporate, I'm going to go and acquire a petrol station, which is a really interesting thing to do.
So I'll answer your first question. How did it happen? Moving to Joburg was I need to go back home because Joburg is home. Boksburg, I had already a base because I held a house there. So it made less sense that I moved back to my place. So then the place that I applied for was not in Boksburg. It was somewhere in the Pretoria area. But when there's a couple of sites that usually come up during that process, the Boksburg site came up and I'm like, okay, maybe then I should try this one. It takes literally a year before everything is sorted because there's quite a process. It's advertisement on the site. I recommend that people check the fuel sites, different brands. They advertise petroleum sites on there. That's what I did. I found a site. I went and applied. You've got to have a good idea of the area. You've got to create a business plan that shows the financials, the marketing. You've got to know at least a lot about the financial and the environmental sort of the sort of that area. I had to create that in preparation for this because you go through 3 different interviews. The first one is pretty much around what is it that you know about the site. You present your basic business plan. There's a template, of course, but you've got to have your own so that it can feed into this. It was luck that I actually lived in Boksburg before, so I understood the area very well. I understood the LSM, which worked in my advantage. I understood the dynamics that they wanted in the place. Then we went to the second interview, which pretty much is about the sales and the exec of Shell that will sit down and say, what do you know about this place? What value are you bringing? What is it that you will change? What do the financials look like? Most importantly, do you have the money to buy it? So the preparation we spoke about of 3 years was the money part, right? Because you've got to have at least 20%, depending on which bank you go for, 20 to 40% of the actual capital. I needed to have that money. So during that time, it was the savings. It was like every penny counts because this is what I want to do. So then the availability of that money, proving that you have it. Then after that, it's the actual work. After they say yes, it's the licensing from a DMRE perspective, Department of Mineral and Energy. It takes about 6 months for that to happen, to have a final trading license. You've got to go into now, what is my working capital? What is it that the site looks like? Now it's real. It's no longer on pen and paper. It's how do I make this work? How do I get the money to actually make it work? And I had to get the 20%. Of course, I proved that. I've got to go to all the banks, and Capitec, yay, was amazing. So they actually came out quicker than most of the banks because they look at the risk, right? This is Priscilla, who comes from corporate, who's an IT head. What does she know about petroleum? So it presents a little bit of a, are we getting ourselves into a corner here? Will she do this from computers to petrol? What is she doing? I think they took a leap of faith and they appointed me. I went through a couple of government sort of financial institutions which couldn't come through in time. Some of the banks were a bit slower, but Capitec was much, much faster. And this is where I am. And then the work starts, you pay the person, then you start working. You do not know anything about this business. But what I did, though, which was smart, was between the Lohamka situation and when I took over, I took time to learn the business. Being in a petrol station and just putting petrol is the least complex of all. But when you get into the business, there's so many things that you have to be aware of. There's so many things that you have to comply with. There's a lot of requirements from a business South African perspective, from the licensing, from the food safety. There's so many nitty-gritties that I had to comply with. But because I had already went at least a year, I used to go to this other lady who helped me quite a lot in Pretoria. I used to go to her at least 180 hours that I spent with her just to understand the business, because the first one I didn't get because I didn't have the operational knowledge. And then it was a challenge for me, like, go for the operational knowledge. And I had to go and learn. And it was quite interesting. I'm like, sure. We just come in and pump petrol and we're like, I'm paying and that's it. There's quite a lot of things that happens behind the scenes. So yeah, that's how the journey was and how I got into a relationship with Capitec as well.
Yeah, very cool. I love that that's come through. I mean, I was going to ask you what difference Capitec made in the process. I mean, you've already answered the question, which is lovely. And like you say, it's such a big adjustment actually going into a business, right? So you spoke earlier about how if you'd stayed in corporate, maybe you would have been able to study further. I think you've learned much more by leaving corporate and actually spreading your wings and going out into a business like this, because that's the biggest thing with entrepreneurship. You have to understand the entire business, and then you have to actually figure out how all of the different elements work. And this is where it's so interesting. So especially with a business like that, I can imagine the risk and compliance stuff must be through the roof, because I mean, it's as flammable as it gets. Let's call a spade a spade. A forecourt is basically a great big bomb inside concrete, you know? So it comes with a ton of health and safety stuff. And then you've got the store, which has to have the right strategy for the area. So like you said, you've got to understand the local area because it's a retailer. And like any retailer, if you don't understand the average customer, a forecourt in a very rich area is going to sell something completely different to a forecourt in a lower income area. And you can see it when you look at the specials. If you go into a fancy area and you put petrol in your car, you're going to go into the forecourt. They're going to have freshly baked goods. It's going to be Magnums on sale. It's that kind of vibe. When you go into a lower income area, it's pies and it's Score energy drinks. And you know, you've got to respond to the people in the area. That's how retailers make money. So there's a lot to learn. I can imagine it's been such an interesting business. And when you look back on it now, and as you continue to run this thing, what would you say was actually the biggest challenge in getting up the curve on understanding how the business works? What was really, really difficult? And then which pieces do you think was maybe a little bit easier?
I think for me, the people part was the most challenging part. Forecourt, there is a best practice, so you probably can. If you're from corporate, you're used to standard operating procedures, you know that compliance, this is what I should do. From the shop perspective, I had a little bit of knowledge around what LSMs are there, what is it that I need to sell, like we used to sell things that are not relevant. And you look at the pricing and that. So you cannot have a strategy. But human beings, you can't have a strategy for, because they are very different in nature. But I've always been very fascinated by a human mind, especially now that I've moved from managing professionals and managing now the forecourt staff. It's very different, like the different kind of spaces. So for me, it was that. You'll be surprised that because this is a sends and rents business, theft is a huge thing. So that was my challenge. How do I make the team be part of the business? If you get what I mean. Most of the time we employ people, but I wanted them to be part of the business and care about the business. Because if you do, then you get them to be loyal and know that if I steal, then I would not be able to get a salary. You that understand. And also the customer service aspect of it, because I've always been very passionate about customer service. We don't want you to come to the garage. The last thing I wanted is to be in the forecourt and you're trying to pour petrol and it takes 10 minutes. I'm like, what are we doing? So I wanted people that are energetic. I wanted the spirit that I have, the passion of what I do, and the pride of what I do. I mean, I love owning a petrol station. I love being on that forecourt and pouring petrol in that car.
I was going to ask if you are there pumping petrol sometimes. I can totally imagine you doing it.
I am pumping petrol.
There we go. I knew it.
I'm pumping petrol. I'm being a cashier. I am everything basically most of the time. Of course, not all the time, because there's things that I need to do. But if there's a forecourt is full, I will say, give me my tag, I'm going to go on that forecourt and hoy.
Nice.
Because we need these cars to move. And also, this is a business where you have to be highly involved. And the fact that I knew, I didn't know. You know, it's a very good position to be when you say, I've only learned this for the past 14 months. Compared to someone who's been doing it for 5 years, they assume that they know. But I knew I didn't know enough. So I had to learn what I learned in the other spaces. Now I had to practice, replicate. And the only way to do that is to be involved. Be in that case, you understand when a customer says, "Ah, oh, you're always out of grandpa, what is wrong?" Then you know what to address. Or when you are in the forecourt and the person is upset because he said he wanted 100 rand and they weigh 200 rand. So you find ways of having a strategy on how do we satisfy a customer at the same time that I don't lose money. So yes, I love being on that forecourt, and I always say I'm from heels to boots. Safety boots, because you're wearing your safety boots on the forecourt. You have to be an example. I can't come and wear heels on the forecourt. It will be a health and safety HSSE issue. So yes, I am on the forecourt all the time. Very involved financially. Cash ups, I do it. I check every little cent from banks. The merchants was another thing that I thought it's easy. Banks do not take 2 seconds to open a merchant account. It took like months. So yeah, but the human element was the challenge. But I think I'm in a space where everyone understands what I expect. It's been like months or over a year, 14 months or so. And they understand what I'm at. They see it live. They see the passion. So you can't not have passion. If the person who owns the place actually goes on the forecourt, why do you say I can't? So it's been quite a challenging part of this for me. The other parts are pretty much standard. I was able to comply. And why I say it's been something that I'm proud of is this quarter, out of 593 stations, I'm number 15, and I haven't even traded 2 years. So
wow.
This is the ride that we are doing.
Sure, well done. And yeah, I mean, I love the passion coming through there. It's so obvious. That's why I guessed that you were probably out there, as you say, hoeing petrol, because you just strike me as someone who gets involved. And I think that's key here. I was going to ask you if you have to actually be there all the time, or can you trust a kind of station manager to get it done? And I guess when people own multiple forecourts, you can't cut yourself into lots of pieces. So you have to get to the point where you have people you can trust. But I guess early days like this, you've got to understand how the entire business works. And that's an interesting point, because I've seen people in my life who have started businesses and they start something where they either have very little idea of how it works, and that's still okay, provided you're willing to learn. But sometimes they say, well, I don't really know how this works, and I'm going to find someone who knows how it works, but I'm going to be the business owner. It's just like, it's a structural problem. You need to understand your business inside out. You need to be able to do all the things it needs. You're not going to do them forever. You got to outsource, you got to find staff, etc. But you've got to be able to jump in and be like, I understand that job. This is how it's going to work, especially for small businesses. And that's one of the big differences to corporate. Corporate, everyone is a cog in the wheel. You understand your world and how it fits in with everyone else, but that's all you need to understand. Whereas when it's your own business, you need to understand the whole thing, right? Inside out.
Yeah. So I do have a site manager that I can now sort of, because part of my role is to scan environment around me, to check the prices in other areas, to understand if I stand, I usually stand in the middle of Makro or any other warehouse and go like, what would I buy if I was my customer? And I will then do that buying and saying, it's Christmas, we have extra money from the bonuses, what would I want? Instead of having Cadbury, I want to indulge and buy a Ferrero Rocher. So why not get Ferrero Rochers and test the market? So I do have someone that I now feel comfortable to leave when I'm not around. But it will be for a couple of hours, of course, he would be an operational person. The other thing is the growth, right? So the innovative part. I'm a select store. Select store means I don't have that big bakery. So I don't have hot food. But can I stay without hot food? Hell no. So I needed to find a way to be creative around it. If I can't make my place bigger, I need to make a plan to sell hot food. And I did. I got the food truck. It was the first. I have a little food truck.
I love that. It's so cool. That's great.
And I am selling hot food, and I'm selling what I think people would like for the market that I'm in. So I have hot food now. When I got there, there was no gas. And I'm like, I have a gas stove. We have an electricity problem. So why not sell gas? Started the process of being compliant with the gas because I didn't have a license. And I now sell gas. So it's those kind of ideas. And this is how you see it when you're scanning your environment and saying, what do we need? Do we need gas? Yes, we need gas. The people that are selling gas close at 6 or 8. I'm 24 hours. So that market after 24 hours, that is why we're a convenience store. Your gas finishes at 8. You're having a braai. So you come to me and buy the gas. So yeah, that's pretty much how it works.
Yeah, it's crazy interesting. The food truck is fascinating. Tell me about the menu. What can someone get when they're hungry there at Charles Boxberg Motors?
We get from sandwiches to pap and steak, because my market is really people that are working in the area. I'm in between the car dealerships. So most of the people on lunch, they don't have anything to eat. So we have the stew, the mokhodu as well. We do have fancy foods like chicken and chips. We sell kota. I don't know if you know what kota is. It's a little bunny chow, so
yep.
We sell those and fat cakes in the morning to accommodate that market. But I also have like samosas. We purely non-pork. If you eat pork, don't come to us, because my market is either people that are halal or people that are not eating pork at all. We all test the market, started selling pork and no one bought. And I'm like, okay, so what is wrong? Because I love pork. So we then saw that it's either a religious thing. So then we stopped selling it and we now get in traction. People are buying more. We do sell toasted semis. We have burgers and all that. So yeah, but most of the high sellers are actually food, pap, rice and stew and all that. Mokhodu is the high sellers on Monday because people have babalas, so they want something like mokhodu to like take away the babalas. Yeah.
Sort them out. Oh, that's great. I have small children, so now I just have, are you aching for some bacon in my head? Courtesy of the Lion King, a gift that I've passed down to them. But there's a great story in there, you know, just because you're aching for the bacon doesn't mean that your customers are. And so you've got to then adapt to the people who are actually coming to your store. If pork is not going to cut it, you take it out. You respond to what people want. It does not help to sell premium croissants to a market who are actually looking for a babalas cure on a Monday morning and, you know, cheap sources of maximum protein and carbs to keep them full.
Yeah.
That's the reality. So that's the cool thing with being in retail. It's also the challenge with being in retail. Let's talk a little bit then, because I've always wondered this about these forecourts. My understanding is that when you sell a liter of fuel, basically the amount of money you make per liter is just about fixed. It's a very highly regulated space around pricing, etc. So you've actually really only got two ways of making more money, because you can't just put the price of fuel up. So you either have to sell more fuel, you've got to get more people coming, or you've got to get people to get out of their cars and walk into your shop, right? I mean, that's what this business comes down to. And I guess at the end of the day, getting people out of their cars is going to be stuff like service, how long it takes to get fuel, but then the shop again, you know, you need to give people a reason to come there, like your food truck, et cetera, et cetera. It's very clever. So is that essentially how the business works? You know, selling fuel is really only one part of it, and the shop is absolutely key to the economics of this thing.
The fuel, as in 93 and 95, that's the case, right? It's highly regulated. You've got to sell it at the amount that the DMRE, because it's set by the Department of Mineral and Energy, even the diesel. But there is a little bit of space to play around with diesel because it's not as regulated as the fuel. So you can go down or up depending on your markets, because diesel is mostly for trucks and you want to attract the trucks. So you've got to be smart around how you price your diesel so that you still have the market come to you. And for me, who has two of the competitors that are like literally 900 meters away, I have to be very cognizant of how I will price my diesel. It is also very regular. They tell you how much it is going to go up with, but then the way that you would want to go down, it's dependent on you. So yes, it is regulated and there is a margin that we do. There's a RAS model, and I don't want to get into the technicalities that I had to learn, by the way, when I got into this, on how you're going to, how much money or how much margin you make. Then on the shop, yeah, you want, ideally, we want to be able to pump more on the forecourt and also get people out of your cars to the truck or to the shop, because I still sell pies. So if you don't want my truck food, we still sell pies and other snacks and carbonated drinks and cigarettes. So basically, we are happy to give you the best service. And also, we are happy to say to my forecourt attendant, hey, can you get me a packet of Ciggies when I pay? And they can do that. So we have extended a value for your money kind of service, where you know that it's a one-stop shop kind of, not yet one-stop shop, it will be one day, but you can get your cigarette and pay at the same time and this guy will do it for you at the quickest way possible. Yeah, we do measure. I'm an efficiency kind of person at heart, so I do literally stand outside and see how long people wait. And if there's no one servicing them, I'm like, what is going on to the person in charge? Or I will personally go and assist. So yeah, you want to get more people in the shop because the shop margins are a little bit different because we're a convenience store. We're not priced like Pick and Pay because of the timing. We're 24 hours. You've got to pay two different shifts as opposed to just one shift for the day. So yeah, what we used to do on Saturdays, we used to have Boerewors roll. That is the one that built into this truck. Boerewors roll, it smells nice. You see it with my little gas. So you get out of your car and park and buy the Boerewors roll. So those are the kind of little things that we do. Sometimes we can partner with some of our suppliers and get little ice creams and give on the forecourt so that people come back again. But the service component is the most important. I want people that I would have tested, that these people are passionate, they are proud, and they love serving people. And they like talking to people. People just want to be spoken to. It's like a salon. When I go to do my hair, the last thing I do is my hair. It's actually the conversation around, you know, what is happening around us. So I've had quite a few comments of people saying, thank you, just for talking to me, you know, and they are sure to come back. So those are the kind of things that my team and I are doing so that people would want to come back to us as opposed to the other petrol stations.
Burries and ice creams, you definitely speak in my language. That sounds excellent. And the human touch, as you say, just being friendly. I mean, it's the basics, but this is what we crave. We crave human connection and ice cream and burries. And if you can get all three of those right, then you are golden. That's how it works. So Priscilla, without giving away specifics, obviously this is private, but I'm just curious, like, what is the journey high level been like for you going from essentially a corporate salary in a big job into your own business? You had to borrow money for it. Would you say it's been tough? Would you say it's been in line with expectations? I mean, again, no specifics here, just high level for people thinking of doing this. What's been your experience of it?
So if you are going into this business, you've got to be able to stop living the posh life. There's no longer a going out and eating out that has stopped, because your salary is the challenge for you. You're paying yourself little. Sometimes you don't pay yourself at all if it's a bad month. So you've got to be able to have a cushion on the side, or you've got to have some support, something, or you have to downscale quite a bit, which I have done. But for me, it's a downscaling that, you know, in 5 years, it will pay back. You know what I mean? It's just that a temporary sort of inconvenience, but you have to be able to take it and be able to adjust, to be agile enough to adjust to your new reality now. That I am not getting that salary that I was getting in corporate. I'm not going to get the 13th check. So how do I balance my life to live the way that I'm living now? If I were to give you an idea, my salary is not even half of what I used to get in corporate. But I love it, because at the end of the year, when you look at your financials month to month, you're like, okay, so it's worth it. At the end of the year, you will see the results, and you're like, in 5 years, I probably will pay myself a little bit better, but I think I will do it again. I don't want to be promising people that you'll get double your salary, because you're not. You will bankrupt yourself. So you've got to be smart around how do you balance, because they do manage your expectations, the franchisors, to say, well, you're from corporate, you're not going to get that salary. How do you balance your finances to still be able to maintain your life? Because you get debts and whatever, right? So you've got to package your life in such a way that you're not going to struggle, but at the same time, you don't pay yourself too much that you won't even make a profit.
Thank you. I think that's a very honest and sobering viewpoint. And that's why I asked the question, because I always think people must just go into this with their eyes open. It's basically, there's this quote that goes roughly along the lines of living the life that others won't, so that you can live the life that they can't in years to come.
Yes.
Take the hard stuff now and it will pay off later. So I've always loved cars, and so I had some interesting stuff. Nothing ever crazy at all. Like, I was always careful, but I had some fun stuff. And then when I finally decided, look, it's time to start like getting out of corporate now, this is the opportunity in front of me, let's do it. I remember I downscaled all the way down to this leaking Fiat, which basically, if it had rained, it would leak straight through like the door, basically onto me. I was like this ex-investment banker CA in this leaking Fiat. But that's what you got to do. You got to humble yourself down to that level. Because that tiny little overhead every month is going to make the difference. If something goes wrong in the business, while your friend is paying off 15,000 Rand a month on some fancy German car. And that's why entrepreneurs actually end up being much better at managing their money, because they actually don't take on unnecessary overheads. They go into a cash mindset of like, okay, did I already make this money? All right, I'll spend some of it. I'll leave behind a buffer, spend some of it, but I had to make it already. They don't go and throw debt at their personal lives. Whereas when you're a salaried employee, you assume that money's always going to be there. And then you're very happy to layer on these big overheads. And it's dangerous, because corporates do retrench people. Things don't always go to plan. And then you're in serious trouble, because now you don't have a plan B. So as much as it's hard to go and do what you've done, you're also in control of your own destiny, right? And that's a nice way to wake up in the morning.
Yes. I've been retrenched 3 times in my life.
Wow. Yeah, you know that gig well. Sure.
So I know how that feels. I am driving a 12-year-old car. Everyone asks me, you're still driving this thing? I'm like, yes, until it stops working, yeah, I will still drive it. I'm not going to buy anything that will get me in the position where I struggle right now. If it moves, it moves. I get there.
100%. I love that. So I think last question on this podcast, it's been such a lovely look at just life leaving corporate. What advice would you give someone who is maybe thinking about doing this in 2026 or beyond, or someone who's now maybe at that point, as we spoke about, where you kind of say, okay, 2 to 3 years from now, that's actually the safer runway. If you're sitting here listening to this and you're going, oh, 2026 is my year to leave corporate, be careful. It takes longer than that. So what advice would you give someone who's in that situation, they're in their corporate job, they're dreaming of leaving to go and do this thing? What would your one piece of advice be?
Stop being fearful. Just jump in it. And start planning today. Because as you said, the day that you decide, it takes at least 2 years. So it's just a change of mindset. I'm going to stop being afraid. I'm going to do this. And now you start defining the how. and you start saving money, you start looking into where you want to go into. It was a collision with petroleum, but I loved it. I think it was meant to happen. I do think that our journeys are supposed to be somewhere and you will be somewhere. But, you know, it collided with me and I love it. Sometimes people are born with a passion that they are underestimating and then they die without actually pursuing it. So one day when you decide in 2026, make a decision, I'm an artistic person, I need to get into open my art shop and start working towards that art shop. There are a lot of banks that are actually with a good business case like Capitec will be able to fund you. If they see the logic, they see that you've managed your money properly and you have a contribution, they'll be able to help. I think a lot of people have this comment that I don't have money. It's a limitation only because you are fearful. So if you stop being fearful, then you look at possibilities. You can see that it is possible if I really, really want to do it. And that is where I was. I would say that stop being fearful, pursue what you love and go for it. Even if it doesn't yield the results in 2 days, because I was an impatient person. I think the one thing that this business has taught me is to be patient. The waiting game. In 4 years, 3 years, whatever, it will be a different thing. Just like hold on. And when they listen to this kind of podcast, they'll be able to see that it can be done. If a dusty kid from Sebokeng can do this, anyone can, really. It's just go above the fear and leave corporate. And I know I used to be one of the execs and I'm like, oh yeah, it's a prestigious, but for who? For me, now I'm prestigious to me. I'm the one who makes decisions and that's different, you know. So when you are in corporate, you're working for someone else who had the dream to do what they're doing, then they hire you to do it for them. So in my opinion, I am better off doing my dream than working for someone else's dream. So dream, go for your dream and stop being fearful.
Yep, I love that. Loads of great advice in there. It's funny. So my thing is being able to fetch my kids from school without having to ask someone. That's the biggest win for me. It's not even about the money or whatever. It's literally just the freedom. The richest person you know is the person who has the most control over their time. That is my honest opinion on the world, really. Priscilla, I don't know, have you read The Alchemist before? Because if you haven't, you should.
Yes, I have read The Alchemist. Funny enough, it was like 14 years ago. I still have it. I go back to it. So yes, I have.
Now, you struck me as someone who should read it. So, and anyone listening to this, there really are two types of people who read The Alchemist. There are those who read it and go, I don't understand the hype. What is this? And then it wasn't for you, you know, that's fine. And then if it is for you, it will really be for you. So I was one of those people where it was really for me. I took a lot from The Alchemist. I remember reading it on a flight between Joburg and Cape Town, a late night, very tired, hardcore financial services career flight. And I read The Alchemist and I just remember, I basically read it, closed it. And that was the start of it ended up being much more than 2 to 3 years, but that was kind of the start of me going, okay, like this is, I need to do something else long term. So yeah, it's a lovely thing.
There's those books that never leaves my shelf. And The Alchemist is one of them. Rich Dad, Poor Dad is one of them. It's just those that makes me think, you know what, if these people could do it, I can too. And there are people that have poured into me as well that would say, you can do this. And I'm like, okay. So yeah, but The Alchemist was one of them.
It's fantastic. So there's a dog in the background there that is calling you to go and run your business. So I'm going to let you go, Priscilla. Thank you so much. We were done anyway, but it has been lovely. Thank you so much. We'll take the dog's hint here and just good luck. Well done on everything you're doing. It's a very inspiring story and I really wish you the best with it.
Thank you so much, guys.
Real stories and real people. Yours could be next. Plugged in with Capitec. Capitec is an authorized financial services provider, FSP 4669.